How at home are you in the dark? The darkest place I've ever been was in a cave. There's a place called Crystal Cave in Wisconsin. I grew up in Minnesota. Vacationing in Wisconsin was somehow extravagant. I remember in the cave the sound of water dripping. I remember the sound that people's shoes made scuffing around on the floor, kind of like when a dancer puts the cornmeal on the stage, does that thing, that same kind of gritty kind of sound. It was cool, a heavy sort of coolness because the air was so damp in there. The caves and its chambers were strung with lights, and there were things glistening and sparkling and shining everywhere in my memory. We were part of a tour group being led by a cave docent, I guess. They talked about the different features that we were seeing and how the cave was formed. I remember none of that. I remember that the tour progressively, slowly went lower and lower and lower. And the climax of the tour was when we were as deep as people were allowed to go in the cave. There's a group of, a dozen of us or so standing there facing the tour guide, and then they said that they were going to turn out the lights. I don't remember the guide going anywhere or touching any button or switch. All I remember is all of a sudden it's black, pitch black. Couldn't see anything at all. I couldn't see the hand in front of my face, and I tried it. I put my hand in front of my face, and I could not see it. It wasn't like darker here and not quite as dark in other places. It was all just dark. I brought my hand so close to my face that I could feel it, so I was pretty sure I still had the hand. I could feel it there. I could not see it at all. I couldn't see any of the people around me. They were still there. I was fairly confident of that. I could hear them move. The cave docent must have asked us all to be quiet and still, because I don't remember anybody talking during this. I could hear maybe a gasp, maybe another foot scrape along the stone floor. And then the lights came back on and we all went up, 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 a long staircase back to the surface. Darkness is something that we need. Darkness is something that all life needs, and yet it is something that we don't usually respect. We stay up long after the sun sets, but we have the lights on. We're denying the dark. We're staring at glowing screens. We're trying to be productive. We're trying to entertain ourselves. We're trying to distract ourselves from how dark it is. The cycle of darkness and light is something that all living things seem to respect. All living things have a rhythm to their living. The sleep researcher, Matthew Walker, says that every animal species carefully studied to date sleeps or engages in something remarkably like it. This includes insects such as flies, bees, cockroaches, and scorpions, fish from small perch to the largest sharks, amphibians such as frogs, and reptiles such as turtles, Komodo dragons, and chameleons. Even invertebrates such as primordial mollusks and echinoderms, and even very primitive worms enjoy periods of what appears to be slumber. All life has a rhythm to it. But we tend to deny and devalue half of that cycle. We can be night owls and work all night, but we're turning our nights into day because the dark is bad, the dark is evil. Or maybe just thinking literally or scientifically, we think of darkness as simply the absence of anything, emptiness, nothingness. There's nothing there in the dark. Darkness has no presence. But of course, it does have presence. I felt it when those lights went out down at the bottom of that cave. In the 60s, the theologian and teacher and mystic Howard Thurman wrote a book about segregation and where hope might be found. In the prologue of the book, he quotes a passage from a term paper that one of his students turned in to him. The student was a deep sea diver and was writing to describe what that is like. And the student writes this: "En route to the floor of the ocean, the diver first passes through the belt of fishes. This is a wide band of light reflected from the surface of the sea. From this area, the diver moves to a depth of water that cannot be penetrated by light above the surface. It is dark, foreboding, and eerie. The diver's immediate reaction is apt to be one of fear and sometimes a sudden spasm of panic that soon passes. As the diver drops deeper and deeper into the abyss, slowly their eyes begin to pick up the luminous quality of the darkness. What was fear is relaxed, and the diver moves into the lower region with confidence and peculiar vision." The Luminous Darkness is the title that Thurman gave to his book. I want to just pause a moment with that image and consider staying in the dark, feeling fear and maybe even panic arise, but sticking with it, staying with the dark, allowing your eyes slowly to adjust, and becoming aware of a luminous quality in the darkness. This story from his student made Thurman think of Psalm 139, which has lines that go like this: "If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you." In the dark at the bottom of that cave, I'm not sure that my eyes perceived any luminosity. It was just dark. But in the dark, I did become aware of other things. I could hear my dad breathing next to me. I could even feel the warmth of him that close. I could hear the sounds that people make even when they're standing quietly and still. And more, I felt my own shock at being plunged into darkness. I felt my craving for light. My craving for light is a craving that I have learned and rehearsed, partly due to the pressures of society, mostly due to my dislike of feeling fear or apprehension or just not knowing. I love the light and all it can reveal, but for a long time now, I have felt a growing craving for darkness. Maybe that's because the world is just getting brighter and brighter and brighter. The physicist Christopher Kiba and his colleagues made a study of the growing brightness of the night sky, and they report that trends in the data showed that the average night sky got brighter by 9.6% per year from 2011 to 2022. Which is equivalent to doubling the sky brightness every 8 years. Most of us are seeing fewer and fewer stars in the night sky. There's too much light pollution. The Presbyterian pastor Cort Gatliff was leading a Bible study, and they were reading a passage together from Genesis where God is reassuring Abram by telling him to look up at the night sky. "Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them," God says. "So shall your offspring be." So Gatliff gave his study group this little homework assignment. He told them, "Take a few moments to go outside, look up, and marvel at the glory and goodness of our Creator." One participant joked he would attempt to count the stars and report back his findings. Like a good teacher, Gatliff took it upon himself to do this homework too. He says, "When I stepped outside to do some stargazing of my own, what I saw was less than awe-inspiring. Despite it being a clear night and close to a new moon, the darkest of the moon's phases, I could actually count the stars. There were 12. Where did they all go? I wondered. The answer, of course, is they're still up there. We just can't see them anymore. We don't know what we don't know. It's so bright, the night sky that we take for granted is disappearing from view. When's the last time you had a view of the Milky Way? We don't have enough darkness. Gatliff notes that the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History has an exhibit that's up now and will stay up through December 2025. And it's called Lights Out, Recovering Our Night Sky. They want to help people discover why dark nights matter, rekindle your connection with the night sky, and consider how much light at night is enough. For whom? For what purpose? And who gets to decide? When I was visiting my family in California last February, we all drove out to the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park, and it was proudly proclaiming itself a certified dark sky place. If you start typing Anza-Borrego Desert into the search bar of your browser window, it will suggest that what you really want to type is Anza-Borrego Desert Stargazing. I'll be taking a brief 2-month sabbatical next summer. And at the moment, what I'm thinking is that one of my main focuses for that time is going to be looking for dark skies. Light dispels mystery. It makes us think we know what's there. For the health of our souls and our society and our planet, we need to turn out the lights and consider how much we don't know. The writer Pico Iyer gave a TED Talk where he argues that the opposite of knowledge isn't always ignorance. It can be wonder or mystery, possibility. And in my life, he says, I've found it's the things I don't know that have lifted me up and pushed me forwards, much more than the things I do know. We need to be able to acknowledge the darkness and cultivate a resilience that helps us to refuse to dismiss the dark. The dark has things to teach us. We've been trained to look for enlightenment. But enlightenment can have us believing that up, up, and away is the only goal. I think we need to stick with the mysteries that are right here, closer to home. The Dharma teacher and writer Deborah Eden Tull notes that the idea of enlightenment has been filtered through many generations of patriarchy, colonialism, capitalism, imperialism, and individualism, moments that continually discounted the physical body, human emotion, other forms of knowing, relationships, the natural world, feminine wisdom, indigenous spirituality, and the mystery itself. The overlighting of human consciousness has nearly worn us out and has almost decimated our planet. But the night remains the night. The receptivity and sensitivity of our bodies are intact. The mystery from which we all came and to which we will all return has not dissolved. Or as the poet Otena O'Danner writes, darkness is free and abundant. There is joy in unfurling from the shadows we were made in. We need only close our eyes to go home. What Danner is talking about here as home, I think, is an experience rather than a location. It's a way of being. It's the experience of connection with the earth, with the cosmos, with possibility. Tull believes that as our world changes physically and socio-politically, as more and more people are displaced or feel uprooted, by the omnipresent insecurity of global uncertainty, we crave home. Home is not a physical place. Home is wholeness, the field that unifies. Home is wholeness, and wholeness means acknowledging both the light and the dark. They are connected. In an ancient Buddhist poem, light and dark are described in this way: within light there is darkness, but do not try to understand that darkness. Within darkness there is light, but do not look for that light. Light and darkness are a pair, like the foot before and the foot behind walking. We move by moving through darkness and light, and we couldn't move if there was just one or the other. Tull explains, it is in our original nature to celebrate the spectrum and interplay of dark and light. Night and day, receptive and expressive, yin and yang, emptiness and fullness naturally exist in dynamic balance together. This can be difficult to grasp from binary perception, which continually insists on this or that instead of this and that. In order to know this balance, we need to remember how to respect darkness, listen to darkness, and yes, to dance with darkness. We crave home. And I'm thinking of home as a place where we can navigate in the dark. Home is the place that you can navigate in the dark. May we imagine embracing rest and dreams. May we recognize our need for darkness and night as much as we do our desire for lightness and day. May we acknowledge any feelings of fear and panic, and may we let them pass and allow ourselves to dive deeper. May we honor the darkness, even as we step into the light.